I'm Christopher Lydon with the economic wise man and political wise guy, Mark Blythe, whose predictions all year are coming due about the price of austerity, about how far you can kick a can down the road, about who's going to get a haircut when the bluffing is over in this unending economic crisis. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with a Sean Connery Scots accent you can cut with a knife when Mark Blythe wanders into the pub. Mark, your summer assignment was to make this problem disappear.
I failed. I failed spectacularly.
I'll say you did.
Well, actually, at the start of the summer, I went off to Brussels. I mean, if you're going to go somewhere interesting, let's go to Brussels, where they have the EU based. And I was asked to go to this conference, and it was all the sort of European left parties getting together. And I thought, you know, well, these are a bunch of people that obviously know how much trouble they're in. So I gave a big speech where I said, this is how much trouble you're in, and you're going to have a huge meltdown in your markets during the summer, and you've been kicking the can down the road, you're going to run out of road. And I told them all the things that we've already spoken about. And they looked at me as if, you know, really I had just done something unspeakable in a church. I mean, they just didn't get it. It was really quite amazing. They were actually shocked by what I said. And I was then shocked by the fact that they were shocked, because I was like, really? What did you think's going on here? So there's an incredible disconnect in Europe about what's actually going on. And they're still surprised by events. You know, it's a bit like, you know, a toddler that's, you know, surprised every 5 minutes. Really? You're surprised every 5 minutes? And that's the way that they're behaving. What we're seeing in the markets now is what was quite predictable 6 months ago. It begins with the banks and it's going to end with the banks.
You're getting famous now for this line that used to be that banks bailed out sovereigns. Now sovereigns bail out banks and the citizens get to pay for it.
That's it.
You said this 6 months ago. There's something there that we just don't want to, we don't want to know. We don't want to recognize. We don't want to deal with.
I think that we're beginning to recognize it now, and it's because the markets at the end of the day, they may not be rational, but they're also not completely stupid. And what they're beginning to figure out is they want two contradictory things. So they were opportunist, and they looked at the debt crisis, the 2008 financial crisis, and said, holy hell, look at all the debt we've made. We need to dump that somewhere. Hey, we're too big to bail. We're too big to fail. You got to help us out. So along comes the state, and they basically take up all the lost revenue and have yawning deficits and so on and so forth. They recapitalize the banks, massive liquidity, QE1, QE2, the whole thing, whatever it takes. And it's all based upon the following assumption, that it was perfectly normal to have 10% of the economy in the US, the financial sector, producing 40% of the profits. That's not normal. So we had a bubble in housing, we had a bubble in equities. And here's what I think the markets are beginning to figure out. They were symptoms. They weren't the bubble. The real bubble was finance itself. We built a financial sector that was completely out of scale, that was designed to basically sit in the middle of trades that was engineering itself and make fees on huge amounts of leverage. And when it all went wrong, somebody else was meant to pick it up. Now, the assumption behind the bailouts, which I fully supported back in 2008 for reasons we've discussed, basically 158 million Americans and 72% of them live paycheck to paycheck, 58 million handguns, this is going to end bad. But I've actually revised this now, because if you think about what's happened, right, we've had 16% unemployment going forward for over 12 months. Nothing's getting better. We knew that consumers were completely over-leveraged. In fact, look at the way I'm talking about this. I'm not talking about citizens, I'm not talking about Americans, I talk about consumers, as if their function is simply to go out and spend with borrowed money from the banks. So this begins with a banking sector which is way too big. Now, the assumption was we'll bail them out and it'll cost a lot, but the maturity is on state debt, how long the state can hold it and what interest rate, is always better than private debt. So in a sense, what we did is we transferred all that banking debt to the public sector. And then the banks quite opportunistically turned around and said, bait and switch, look at that terrible debt the state's got. They've been spending like mad. They need to cut their debt. In other words, you need to pay for our mess. Well, the state was kind of okay with that, because the idea was, well, we got a lot of tax revenue from these guys, and it's possibly one of the few industries we've got that's kind of globally competitive, so we don't want to kill it. We want it to come back to health, so we'll give it all the money it needs and liquidity and everything else, and we'll hope that it starts to grow. Then we'll be able to tax it, and then we'll pay back the debt. We're beginning to figure out it's not going to work, because the actual banking model itself is broken. There's no more equities to hump and dump. The housing stuff is done. It's over. You basically got 10 years of overhang sitting across the developed world. And commodities markets are far too small, ETFs be damned, to basically produce macro bubbles out of that everyone can profit from. So you see banks doing what? Moving to Asia, cutting jobs, deleveraging, cleaning up their assets, trying to, but in an environment in which there's no growth. And why is there no growth? Because the same banks are telling states, cut, cut, cut. But if you keep cutting when nobody else is growing, all you do is shrink the economy. And guess what happens? Your debt to GDP ratio gets bigger, not smaller. So then everyone gets worried. And then they say, look at that debt. They have to cut more. And eventually even the Germans begin to figure out that you can't cut your way to prosperity.
I want to ask you, when's the day of reckoning? I really want to ask you, what is the reckoning all about?
The reckoning is all about realizing that we built a very, very odd system over the past 30 years, whereby we had a global division of labor that was based upon a very unsustainable Amen. Principle. You can always rely on the American consumer to have enough money to buy the stuff that we make elsewhere because it's cheaper. A kind of like David Ricardo Adam Smith version of the world. Division of labor, costs got lower, so even if wages go down here, the cost advantage is still going to be sufficient that you end up with more. It's the Walmart principle. Prices keep falling so you don't have to give anybody a wage increase. There are limits. Because guess what? Stuff costs more. Education goods cost more. Healthcare goods cost more. And at the same time, nobody wants to pay any taxes. So you've got a real problem if you have stagnant wage growth. So individually, it makes perfect sense for any firm to move its production as far away from the US as possible to somewhere where it's cheap. You make more profit. But then why do you expect that everyone else will keep employing Americans at a sufficient level so that their wages will buy all the stuff you're making? That's a bit of a problem. Your banking system has a flaw, which is similar. While it's individually rational for any single bank to grow as big as possible to maximize leverage and therefore how much it can make on its trades, it builds a system that's too big to fail and too big to bail. And as soon as you know that, you've basically got a license to extort money out of governments and out of their publics because you're sitting on a free option, unlimited upside and a very limited downside. And once you know that you've got that, what incentive do you have to play ball? But all of this is contingent upon both of those things working simultaneously. And what makes the magic work? Growth. We just run out of it. There's no growth. Why? Because you've got an economy in the United States that's 70% driven by consumption. And we're consumed out. Let me give you a personal example on this, how absurd this has got. Last year, I paid more tax than General Electric.
Right? And Warren Buffett, probably.
All right. And you got Warren Buffett saying we need to pay more taxes, to which I say, well, really? No shit, Sherlock. on the other hand, I have no debt. None whatsoever. I don't even have a mortgage. I'm basically sitting in cash. I wouldn't touch equities with a barge pole. They might be cheap. They might be going up, but don't hold your breath. Now, if it's rational for me individually to behave like that, what happens if everyone behaves that way? Nobody buys houses. Nobody consumes. Everybody pays back debt. And that's where you get Keynes's paradox of thrift. While it's good for any one person to be saving, if we all save at once, all you do is shrink the economy.
Come back to the moment when you and I started these conversations. It was right about the time that Ireland was going belly up or almost, and it did seem a sort of simple parable of how the bankers conned the country over the cliff and then conned the politicians into saying it was a national debt, therefore we've got to stop health care and education and all of these things. And the people, when it came to a vote, said, hell no, we're smarter than that. Where have we gone from there? At that point, you started saying, well, there's a haircut here for somebody down the road, and sooner or later, it'll happen. But it hasn't yet. What is all this shuffling in the meantime?
Buying time. Let's think about what the Germans have been doing. So there's two stories on the Germans. One, they're a bunch of Teutonic savings-obsessed monsters who want to kill the periphery.
Early toilet training will do it all the time.
Absolutely.
Right?
And Michael Lewis's piece on this is a must-read, regardless if you think it's over the top or not, but in Vanity Fair. But anyway, I digress. So basically, you know, they're obsessed with austerity. You never spend money. It's all the fault of the Greeks, and everyone's like the Greeks, and they spend, and we save, and we're virtuous, and they're bad, right? So there's that version of events, which is actually kind of true. That is part of what's driving it. So what do? Well, you punish them. You make sure that they keep tightening the belt and they have to live up to this agreement to get this much money. And you're just throwing debt after debt and it's not getting any better. And eventually even the Germans will figure out this is a bad idea and then they'll ride to the rescue. That's one version of events. That's the European hopeful. Let's call this one the European practical. All the stuff they've been doing where Merkel comes out and says, I'm never going to authorize this. And 5 days later, she authorizes it. We're never going to bail them out. And then you end up bailing them out. Kicking the can down the road. And as I said earlier, you're going to run out of road eventually. You've got to think about why they're kicking the can down the road. Lots of political reasons. Everything from angry Finns to desperate Greeks and so on and so forth. Regional elections in Germany, all the usual stuff. But there's another better reason. Let's look at the state of French and German banks. Hmm. They're up to their necks in periphery debt. Now, the only way that you survive this is if you get rid of the debt. But if they dump all of that debt at once, they bring about the very catastrophe they're trying to avoid. So what they need is time. They need to basically clean their balance sheets through growth and enable them to basically write down that debt over a number of years. So every little incremental bailout, kicking the can down the road, avoiding the haircut here, passing the put there, is a way of buying time for these core banks to basically clean up their balance sheets. The only problem with this is the first part of that story, which is the austerity fetish. If everyone's trying to be austere at the same time as a bank's trying to grow, where does the bank find the asset growth? There isn't any. So when we were worried about France's AAA rating, we actually weren't worried about France's AAA rating. We were worried about what France's AAA rating meant for French banks.
Hmm.
Because a AAA rated sovereign can bail you, but one who's not, that means that the banks that are actually holding, in the French case, 30% of French GDP in periphery bonds on their books become a huge liability. So you're not worried about France's ability to tax anymore. You're worried about the United States' actual solvency. You're worried about the underlying problem, which begins and ends with the banks. That's where this is. So the Germans have been somewhat creatively, in a kind of Keystone Cops manner, kicking the can down the road to buy time for these guys to get their act together. Only question is, do they actually have the wherewithal to get their act together? I don't think they do.
Do the banks know what they're doing?
That is the $64,000 question. I know some bankers.
I keep wondering who is acting in his own real long-term smart interest here.
But so much of this has to do with how an individual rationality doesn't match up to a collective one, right? So every bank knows. This is Walter Baggio's book, Lombard Street, 1873, first great treatise on banks and banking. And it's about a banking crisis that happened in London. And he has a line in there where he says, any bank that has to come out and say that it's money good isn't. Because the minute you say that, and think about Lehman and think about Bear, right? The minute the big guy comes out and says, we're okay, everyone goes, no, you're not, because you wouldn't have to say that. Now, if that's true, every banker individually knows that it's their own self-interest is to stop that happening. Therefore, what should you do to highly levered institutions that are in trouble? You should give them money. But you don't want to be the guy that lends out the money and ends up being the sucker. So nobody does. So what happens? The guy comes out and says, I'm perfectly fine, which is the signal that you're not. So everyone pulls their money in. And when you do that, you have a liquidity crunch. So what's in the individual interest of the bank, the banker, the whole lot? They know this. But there's an enormous collective action problem in actually solving it. There's your problem right there. It's about trust evaporating. Because it's funny, we talk about moral hazard in banking, right? Which is true, you know, if you give them a license.
Remind us, moral hazard always throws me.
Moral hazard is basically, you should never give me a hire car with comprehensive insurance because I'll drive it like it's, you know, a Porsche, even if it's an economy coupe. I will abuse it because I have a license to abuse it. You've given me an insurance policy. So in the case of the bank's moral hazard is, I'm too big to fail. Therefore, you're going to bail me, so I'll behave like a lunatic. That's the moral hazard problem. It's absolutely true. But here's the other thing we never think about. You can't run a banking system without a sufficient level of moral hazard. Because when you recode moral hazard, it's called trust. You don't actually check every transaction that goes through a bank. You don't actually go vet every counterparty. You do 5 trades a day. You trust that they have the money because they've paid you in the past, because they pay somebody else, because somebody else vouches for them. That's why the big guy never has to come out and say, we're money good. Because the system runs on trust. And the flip side of moral hazard is trust. I trust you to pay me back. But if I don't trust you to pay me back, if I insist on seeing your books for every single transaction, the whole thing just becomes a sclerotic mess. So when we try and clamp down on moral hazard, which is a good idea in a macro sense, in a micro sense, what you're basically doing is stopping the banks do their job, because what banks do is rely on trust.
Speaking of morality, are there any good guys in this game? Take Angela Merkel as an example. Is she being called upon to do the right thing, the statesmanlike thing, the virtuous thing for the world, or not?
in her own mind, I'm quite sure that she thinks she is, basically by saying that we can't live beyond our means, so we all have to live within our means, so we all have to cut at once, and we know where that ends. It doesn't work. It's a fallacy of composition. So in her own mind, absolutely. But where I would want to see real leadership is, and this is interesting that Helmut Kohl came out of his active retirement to actually criticize Merkel on this one, and I think he was quite right. Europe isn't about accountancy. Europe is about bringing a continent together. And it's about responsibility for others. It's about solidarity. It's not about putting your foot on the neck of the Greeks and the Irish. It's about taking it off. Sure, you get to punish them. You smack them around for 6 months. They were bad. You write some new rules. You put them in the box. But then you solve the problem. You come out. You do it. You do it one-time deal. You stop kicking the can down the road. Now, as I also said, there's an interpretation that says, you know what? Kicking the can down the road is actually the only strategy they've got, given the state of their banks. But we've reached a point now where we're getting close to the end of the road. That's what the market noises have been over the past couple of months. Any more volatility in the order of up and down 5% a day in these bourses with the leverage that these banks are expressing with lower growth going forward. And you're talking about the possible insolvency of major European financial institutions. When that happens, this is when Merkel has to become Kohl. She needs to become, or Sarkozy needs to become Mitterrand. They need to come out and say, right, this is Europe, the buck stops here, this is what we're doing, and we end it now. I don't think they've got the capacity to do that.
To be political figures, not just bankers.
To be Europeans in the sense that Europe was founded on, rather than provincial accountants.
Yes. This sounds like your response to the whole austerity kick too. Sort of, enough already with the austerity, you've been bad, you paid for it, but let's get on with it. You've got to grow. It's the only way we can bring anything back. I have a question. I've been thinking about it all summer that I wanted to put to you about this. I mean, I read Paul Krugman and I can sort of understand things at that level. I read Robert Reich. I understand why you have to rebuild. It is not a debt problem. It's a productivity and incomes problem. I get that's enough. And you talked me out of any temptation I would have had to go down the austerity route anyway. But the lingering question and the question I hear too loud from the Tea Party is, would you know, would this country, would this government, would this economy know where to spend the money in a real stimulus program? In other words, is part of the reason we hesitate to plunge into a big stimulus the fact not just that we're cheap or that we don't believe in going into debt now and then, but that we don't know where to put it?
Well, an obvious place to start would be, let's see, the $1 trillion in bridges, tunnels, and everything else that you've got in your infrastructure that was built between 1930 and 1950 and badly needs replaced. That would be a start. These things reap huge dividends. All you need to do now is get on Amtrak and then get on any train in Europe. And it's like, one minute I was living in the 19th century and the other moment I was suddenly in Buck Rogers land in comparison.
And we haven't even mentioned China.
Although they actually then buy new trains and then drive them too fast. But that's an entirely different story. So there's plenty of things that you could do in terms of this. But the thing is, I'm not a stimulus guy in the same way that the people you've mentioned are, for the following reasons. I've always maintained that austerity is not the way forward, but I have never said that debt isn't a problem. Because if you look at the debt overall, you have to just stop looking at government debt. That's just a transference of financial institution debt. Let's look at the indebtedness of the financial sector. Let's look at the indebtedness of households. It's doubled in the UK and nearly doubled in the US over the past decade. Now, let's go back to my story about I'm paying more taxes than GE and I don't have a mortgage and I don't have any debt. You could give me $100,000 just now. And I've got a few ideas for things I'd like to do in business. But if I had $100,000 in debt and you give me $100,000, I'm paying back the debt. It's called deleveraging. And the whole private sector is going to do this simply because, and this is where Robert Reich is right, but I would put the debt problem in front of the income problem. When people have too low incomes, even if you boost their income, they're going to pay back the debt. Either we're going to have a debt jubilee where we wake up one day and we're just like, you know what, this is all too complex. Let's just cancel all the debts. Let's start again, like they used to do in the Middle Ages. Have a sort of like 50-year jubilee debt fair. Highly unlikely. In the absence of that, you've got to deal with the fact that households and firms are over-leveraged. They've got huge amounts of debt and there's very little growth. So unfortunately, here's your best case scenario. And it is a best case scenario because it's not as if it's the end of the world. We're going to look like Japan for 10 years. We're going to spend enough. Hopefully what we do is we're smart enough that the government spends enough to maintain the trend growth in GDP. We don't shrink GDP. What happens then is you have high unemployment and then you have slow growth. And that's not ideal by any means. But what it does is it enables households to get from the underwater position that they are. It allows, if you force the banks finally to mark to market their mortgage assets, you'll begin to clear the housing market. And it will be ugly and it will go through for 4 or 5 or 6 or more years. But at the end of it, I'll be able to take a mortgage on again knowing that I'm buying something that isn't a dead asset. I will be able to invest in a business knowing that there's going to be some growth going forward. At the moment, and what would be great for that is $1 trillion in infrastructure spending. I'm entirely in favour of it. But is that on its own going to get rid of all of the debt that's lying around in the financial sector and in the private sector in general and consumption on balance sheets of households? No. Because if you do, all you're doing is you're basically printing money so that I can pay back my personal debt. Now, at the end of the day, you can do that, but, you know, that's not what's going to happen to stimulus. What happened in the US with its stimulus is not only was it too small, not only do you have a bunch of rotten institutions that meant a lot of it went into completely unproductive and zero boom, zero multiplier assets, all the rest of it. The fact of the matter is you can't spend enough to solve this problem because it's a huge debt problem. But it's not the government debt. That's the key thing. Stop looking at that. That's not the issue. In fact, you want more government debt going forward because that's the only thing that's going to allow the private sector to emerge from its debt.
I'm kind of relieved to hear you say that, that there is a kind of a little bit of a mental illness out there, people thinking in vast masses here and in Europe, that you can just, you know, put it on the tab, put it on the card forever.
This is where Robert Reich is right. You've got to do something about income growth. But it's not clear how you do something about that when you've taken most of those jobs and then stuck them in another country on the assumption you'll always be able to buy something cheaper in Walmart.
We don't want to go through a Japan decade of just helpless stagnation.
Yeah, hold on a second. Let's put this in perspective. Have you been to Japan? It's a pretty nice place, right? That decade of helpless stagnation is actually okay. It's got more modern infrastructure than we have by a factor of 12. It's got better educational outcomes. People live longer. So let's put this into perspective what this actually means. It means that you don't have absurd growth in a housing bubble. It means that you don't go back to basically people betting their entire fortune on an internet stock. We stop the casino. We chill out for a while. We pay back some debt. It's probably a good idea. But we're not going to do that if we slash government budgets at the same time as we're all trying to sell the private. You can't do both.
Do we want a Japan decade?
Well, what's the alternative? Like you say, we can just stick it on the credit card again. Well, can you keep doing that? Actually, you can for longer than people think because we still have the world's reserve asset. Chinese consumption is $2 trillion. US plus EU consumption is $20 trillion. One doesn't lever out 10. We can forget about Asia saving the whole thing. That's just a fiction. The whole global economy is skewed towards basically continuation of the dollar as a reserve asset. We've got a way to go. Let's remember that in Britain, at the end of World War II, well, last time we had austerity Britain, there was 246% debt to GDP after World War II. Now, two things. Are we saying that we shouldn't have killed the Nazis because we're worried about debt? Of course not. But here's the really interesting thing. When we had 246% GDP, you know, debt to GDP, you know what we did? We built the welfare state. Now we've got half of that, not even half of that. You've got a quarter of that in Britain, and we're told we can't afford the welfare state. That's politics by other means. So we've got a way to go in terms of what we can do. I'm just not sure that basically a massive consumption binge is what we need. Because guess what? That was kind of the problem.
Who's going to tell the people that we're going through to Japan and you're going to like it? And you'll be a better boy, a better citizen, a happier lady when it's over?
Well, you're not. And basically, unfortunately, because the United States has such a crappy welfare state, those people who are going to be most affected are the ones who were least benefited by the bubble on the way up. And they're the ones who are going to have their budgets cut. They're the ones that are not going to see their jobs coming back. We're now seeing the American labor market for the first time in over a decade, actually over 15, 20 years, in fact, where the total labor force participation rate has gone down and it doesn't seem to be going up. So we're actually, our labor force is shrinking and unemployment's going up. This is a horrible situation to be in. But can we just turn on the money pumps and then that will result in unemployment? Well, here's the problem. Money's not the problem. Apple's holding more cash than the US. Did you see this one in the papers?
No.
Apple's sitting on more cash reserves than the US is. Absolutely crazy. These companies have got more money than they know what to do with, and they're all sitting on the sidelines. Why? Because they're worried about the future. Well, of course, if you listen to the Republicans on this, they're all worried about Obamacare and regulation. Complete nonsense. What they're worried about is the fact that where's the consumption going to come from? They know that consumers are up to their eyeballs in debt. They know that they're worried about their mortgages. They know that they're worried about their jobs. So why would they make big investments now and hire lots of people? Again, it's that collective action problem. It's individually rational for every corporation to sit on cash, even though if they all do it, you shrink investment. And if you shrink investment, you can't have job growth. So what you do is you spend, you revisit infrastructure, you rebuild America, you do it properly. And that will keep the trend rate in GDP going long enough for balance sheets to basically be cleared in the private sector. And then you'll grow again. Then you'll grow again like a bandit. You'll go nuts. It'll be great. Getting there is going to be ugly. And I don't see it. There's no quick fix alternative. I just don't believe there is.
Does anybody, including you, have a name for the new Obama economic policy?
I'm sorry, there is one?
That's the question.
Well, I haven't seen it. I don't know what it is.
I mean, we used to know how to blame it on Larry Summers. Who do we blame it on now? That doesn't seem to be a policy.
Well, I mean, you can blame it on the president or whatever for basically giving in to the Republicans for what we need to do is fiscal consolidation. But if you look at it, you know, the real fiscal consolidation isn't going to kick in until after the next election when it becomes somebody else's problem. And if you believe Congress's post-election promises, I've got a bridge in Brooklyn to sell you. So, you know, we'll see where that one goes. Basically, they've bought the narrative that the problem is government debt and the solution is to cut government debt. And once you do that, then you're not going to grow. So you're going to make things worse. That's it. There is no new economic policy. The new economic policy is the same policy as 1931, and that didn't end too well.
People I know have bought into just the opposite general idea that the problem is a lack of middle-class income, failure to tax the wealth of the mega-rich, and a general downsizing and waste of our economic capacity. How would you treat that?
I agree with all that. I'm not different from that at all. I just add one variable into the equation, which is, you know, I'll draw right from my own personal experience, again, which is debt. Right. If all of that can be true, and I really want Americans to have income growth, and I really want to have a high rate of investment, and I really want all these good things to happen, and actually, I'm a Keynesian at heart. I do believe in fiscal multipliers and stimulus. I think they work. But when everyone's up to their eyeballs in debt, if you give them money, they pay back their debt. Or they hoard it. Corporations are hoarding. We are paying it back. I don't see how that results in a massive stimulus.
Is there a way out of here?
Yeah, next time, don't get yourself into so much debt. It's stupid. And go to your political leaders and say, you know what? It really is kind of crappy that I haven't had a real income gain since 1979. Why is that? Why is it for all this labor market deregulation and flexibility and globalization, I'm more insecure and I'm more poor than I was back in the 1980s? Why is it no matter how many skills I get, it costs more and more to get these skills and I got less and less return for them? That's what we should be saying. That's what we should be concerned with.
Mark Blythe, that sounds like a speech you could give both to the Tea Party and to the AFL-CIO.
Yes, because they're basically looking at the same problem from opposite ends and coming to different conclusions. But they're right about one thing. They got stiffed. Really stiffed. And the banks that did it are trying to stiff them again by dumping the debt on the government. But ultimately, that government debt, it's your debt. And that's what the Tea Party and the AFL-CIO both get. They just completely disagree about how to solve the problem.
Mark Blythe, it's a joy to have you back in the pub. Don't go away again.
Well, I'll try not to. I'll bring my Sean Connery accent back next time as well. All the best, Mish Moneypenny.
Thank you. Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.